back, session number 10657, and this is reel number 20.
Yes, I think there would have been a company clerk, and he would have been on the strength of company headquarters. That's if the company was at full strength. But on those occasions when it wasn't, you probably couldn't afford to take a man away from one of the sections, and any clerking had to be done by the company commander or the company second in command. I do remember in the southern sector of the other main line, I used to have to keep my own talc board up to date with the section commanders and all the men in the various sections.
Was there a lot of record keeping done, permanent record keeping done at company level, or was that mainly battalion?
No, I would have said that the most of the record was done at battalion, really, the record keeping. I mean, we had to report if anybody was killed or wounded or anything like that. But those reports were all consolidated together at battalion headquarters.
And you mentioning earlier on the removal of the dead who'd be taken out at night. What would happen to them after that? Would they be buried in the battalion area? Or
not necessarily. They might have been taken back as far as 149 field ambulance or something like that, where the field ambulance has probably got an area. Don't think they would have been buried in the battalion area. No.
You were saying also, I think, that it wasn't malaria that...
No, when I was trying to get it right, it was definitely jaundice that used to knock people off. And they had when they were away with that, they could be away for 4 or 5 weeks in hospital in either Cairo or Alex or somewhere. So if anybody got that, it seriously depleted. You could get one of your best men down with jaundice, you'd lose him for 5 or 6 weeks.
What was the cause of this disease?
Yellow jaundice, I think they called it. I don't know. At one stage, I remember, somebody suggested in a rather light-hearted fashion that it was due to the amount of whiskey and gin that was being consumed. And then we gave a bit of thought to this and realised that two of the heaviest whiskey and gin drinkers in Cairo and Alexandria had never had jaundice, so it couldn't have been that. I don't know what it was. It could have been a combination of circumstances, I suppose, but it was very unpleasant.
You mentioned burying the adjutant and having the padre there. Was there a strong religious feeling in the company?
Well, in the battalion. You come onto padres here, really. We had Roman Catholic padres right the way through the war, right until the very end, when we were disbanded at Harrogate, and they were marvellous. The troops loved them, they got on very well with them, and Padre Nesbitt, who we had at that particular time, was a very, very likeable bloke indeed. And whether you believed in God or whether you didn't, you went along with what the padre said. In any case, Julian Parker hadn't been long with the battalion, but there were several of us who'd got very friendly with him, and I don't think the padre had to say to us, shall we have our little service tomorrow morning? I think we probably said to him, we would like a service, would you do it for us? It was a normal sort of thing anyway. There would be, if you were able to do so, there would be a little service of that sort. No, it wasn't that we were all 100% practicing Christians or anything like that, but it just seemed the right thing to do.
Was the battalion mainly Roman Catholic? Was that why?
No,
you had?
No. I don't know why we had Roman Catholic padres. I don't know why it was, but we did, and they were always very, very good. Oh no, the battalion was mixed, very mixed, C of E and Roman Catholic.
What's the padre's main function? What did he do?
Well, the padre's main function really was to look after the well-being of the troops. I mean, if somebody got a letter, if one of the men in my company, for instance, got a letter from home saying that from his wife, saying that, you know, she was going to call off the marriage because she'd found somebody else and she wanted a divorce. I mean, that's the sort of thing you get in touch with the padre straight away, so that he could come down and either the man concerned would go back to battalion headquarters, or the padre would have come down in the evening to the forward positions and talked to him about it and tried to sort of make him feel a bit better about it. Might even have suggested that he should write a letter straight away and tell him what he should write. Well, they could do a tremendous amount. A good padre could do a tremendous amount for the morale of a battalion, actually. And we had good ones. They were very good.
It has been said that there would be an increase in religious feeling and practice just before going into a battle. Did you observe that in the battalion?
No, I don't. I don't. No, I think you might be talking about units that are able to get together, you know, to have the whole battalion assembled or something like that. But we didn't have that sort of situation before Alamein. But I think it really came down more to the individual feelings of officers and men. I can't remember, although maybe later in the war, but I can't remember at this time that we'd ever had the battalion assembled together in one place and had a church service or anything like that. Certainly we weren't able to do so at Alamein. We might have done when we got up to Benina after Alamein, but I'll have to have a look at that later on.
So you were in Beachy Head and you had suffered this disaster
Yes.
with a single raiding aircraft.
That's right. And the attack was actually timed for that night. It did get postponed, but at that particular time it was timed for that night. So Colonel Jackson took the IO, the company commanders, in the afternoon to liaise with the Australians who were in forward positions in the Alamein line. And on the way up we could see evidence of the fighting that had taken place. There were knocked out tanks, guns, troop carriers, Bren carriers, an Australian ambulance that had been machine gunned from the air with its, I always remember, its doors were sort of swinging on their hinges, the tyres that were all punctured, and the ambulance was absolutely riddled with bullets, you know, these certain things like that you always have with you. When we arrived and asked the in the area of the battalion headquarters, we were in two jeeps, I think, at the time, and an Aussie stripped to the waist appeared out of a slit trench, and we asked him where battalion headquarters was, and he said, over there, and he said, and you better get out of those jeeps if you don't want to get your heads blown off, in very, very rough Australian. So we piled out of the jeeps, and we found the headquarters of the 22nd Australian Battalion. The company commanders then went forward to meet their opposite numbers, that's to say the Australian company commanders, in the area where we would start from for the attack. And they told us a little about the immediate front, where they thought there was a German Spandau on the right, not very far beyond the Australian wire, and those sort of things. They were able to give us quite valuable information by day, of course, as to what it looked like, as to what there might be in front of us. Whilst all this was going on, the British and Australian guns were having quite a duel over our heads, and also the Spandau was sending the odd bursts of fire over us. And on the way back to our jeeps, another Australian appeared out of a slit trench and asked us if we were the coveys who are going in tonight. And we said yes. He said, well, pointing in direction of the machine gun fire, he said, be sure and fix those bastards. They think they're there for the duration. We'd hardly got in the jeeps when three Stukas appeared from the direction of the British gun lines with Spitfires right on their tails. And the Stukas streaked over us, and as they started, they got level with the German lines, the Spits peeled off and wheeled round to the left. And that was that. The German AKAK opened up as the Stukas got over their lines and the Spitfires peeled away. And we realised at that particular time that apart from the patrolling, the southern sector of the Alamein line had really been almost a tea party. We got back to the battalion to find that the attack had been postponed for 24 hours.
What general impression did you get of the Australians on this visit to them?
Oh, very rough and ready. No, not... Excuse me, sir, but are you taking over tonight? Nothing like that. It was just sort of, hey, mates, addressed to Colonel Jackson, our CO. You know, and if you don't put your bloody heads down, you'll get a bloody well blown off. You know, with a bloke who hadn't shaved for about 10 days and stuck his head out of a slit trench, absolutely saturated in perspiration and sweat, filthy dirty, and then disappeared again.
How did the colonel take to this cheery
greeting? Oh, Jake was all right. He didn't. You know, although he was a regular soldier, he'd been in the Eighth Army long enough to know that the Australians and the New Zealanders were very, very different in their approach to officers, to what our troops were.
What were the Australian officers like then? Were they?
Oh, very helpful. They were good. They were good blokes actually, and they spent a lot of time putting us completely in the picture. I mean, they knew, I think, that this was going to be a pretty big operation and not just another takeover for a small attack. And they went out of their way to give us all the information they could.
Were their positions laid out on the same sort of basis as yours would have been?
Well, that I can't remember, but I don't remember whether it was mainly slit trenches or whether it was a permanent trench system. It depends really how long they had been there and what they'd had time to do. There were slit trenches, but whether there was a permanent trench system as well, I can't recollect.
What did the ground look like forward of the Australian positions when you were...
Flat and featureless. You couldn't really pick anything up, you know. I don't know what time it was we went out there, but I think we went out in the afternoon. So... the odds are that it would have been late afternoon. I think it was late afternoon because of the heat haze otherwise. But really there was very little you could see. You couldn't see anything that you could identify out in front. It looked very quiet. And apart from this Spandau, you couldn't even see that. It was just the bursts of fire that were coming over our head. There wasn't a lot they could really tell us, you know. What they could, they did.
There's no sign of any wire then or anything like that?
Well, the Australians had wire in front of them. And there was a minefield gap. I know there was a minefield gap, most definitely. But I can't remember going through any minefields. Or if we did go through any minefields, I don't remember anybody... Well, yes, I'll come to that later on. I think we did have to go through a minefield... But I think we were very fortunate and we didn't have a lot of losses going through it. And I think the Australian wire, there would have been a minefield in front of that before you got to the German wire. But I honestly can't definitely say that there was.
Could you see the German wire or anything?
I don't think so, not from where we were. No, that would have been several hundred yards ahead, probably. So we pulled out of there, and we knew very well that we'd got, more or less the magnitude of what we'd got to do. So the morning of November the 1st, the NCOs and the men were told Monty's full plan. And they were told by the company commanders and the platoon commanders, and where platoons didn't have officers but sergeants, they were told by the sergeants. And they were told everything we had been told. So they knew that it was a very important attack, and they knew what was coming through, provided we managed to punch the hole in the way of armour. Then the CO had his orders conference and decided that we would attack with the normal formation, with two companies up. That was my company, which was B for Baker on the left, and Chris Beattie's company, which was A Company, on the right. C Company was to move in reserve behind A Company. Now, that meant that you'd got your reserve company where it ought to be, following up the right-hand assault company. And although we'd got the Maoris on our right, there was less on our right, because on our left we'd got another complete battalion and the Scottish Brigade. So the right place for C Company to move in reserve was behind A Company. We had two troops of New Zealand anti-tank guns under command of the 8th, and one platoon of medium machine guns, and also a squadron of Valentines in support, which were virtually useless in actual fact. I'm not going to say what they did was useless, but I mean, to have Valentines at that stage of the battle, when even the Shermans and the Grants could hardly cope with the Mark IVs, to have them around at that time was almost suicide. This 28th Maori Battalion, which was under command of the Brigade, its job was to seize a stronghold on the right of the 8th Battalion, about 500 yards from the start line. When they'd secured this strong point, C Company was to come up level with A, to move round to the right and to come into line with A Company, on the right of A Company, once this stronghold had been secured. If I remember rightly, what happened was that the Maoris not only secured the stronghold, but went tearing off in search of further spoils, which they didn't have to do in actual fact, but they just went off on their own to find as many Germans and Italians as they could. Mind you, they were governed by the barrage. They couldn't go beyond that. But not content with securing the stronghold, they went charging off looking for some more victims.
But if you had those three companies in line then, you wouldn't really have a reserve, would you, in the battalion?
No, but they weren't brought into line until that stronghold had been secured. When it was secured, I don't know. It was probably while we were on the move towards the first objective. In fact, it had to be secured, really, before we got to the first objective, because that was only 500 yards, whereas the first objective was 3,500 yards.
So they were effectively clearing your right flank, weren't they?
Yes, that's right, that's right. But, I mean, we could only hear what was... You couldn't really hear what was going on. You could see the flashes and everything. But it was quite impossible to know exactly how it was progressing, because of the noise and the dust and the smoke and everything else. I think the Maoris probably secured it at a pretty early stage and then went charging up level with the Durham infantry, which continued.
You mentioned the anti-tank guns. Were they attached to individual companies, or were they kept under battalion HQ?
They certainly, we didn't, the anti-tank guns didn't move with us. Ours was entirely an infantry operation. They would have been positioned somewhere by the CO once that, I would have thought, once the final objective was reached. And also the machine guns.
So they were for consolidation, really, not for the
assault? They were for consolidation, yes.
And what about these Valentine tanks?
Valentines, I honestly don't know very much about what happened to them. I do know that at a later stage in the battle, after I was out of it, Jake Jackson was seen positioning the Valentines. If they had been level with C Company, level with our forward troops. They'd have been knocked off for sure, very, very easily. But that's the only reference that the only reference I can find to what happened with the Valentine. They certainly weren't with us. We didn't see them at all, not as far as the first objective. So if they made an appearance, it would have had to have been between the first and the final objective.
So you were told your company sector, and presumably you then decided which platoons would be forward.
Yes.
I presume you didn't have all your platoons in a line.
Oh, no, I had two platoons up and one back, in actual fact. Just before I come on to that, we'd got 3,500 yards to go to the start line, which is about to... from the start line was the first objective. That's about 2 miles. And the idea was for the lead troops to halt on that first objective for 30 minutes. It had the code name Cherry, and it was on the map, although... how on earth anybody could find it, I don't know, but it was the 865 Eastern Grid. That seemed to be a bit of useless information, really. But it was called Codename Cherry, and the pause for 30 minutes was partly for the infantry to reorganise while our guns lifted for a half an hour to fire on the German positions between the first objective and the final objective. And that line, that the final objective, was about 2,500 yards beyond the first objective with the code name Brandy. So you can see from that from the time the guns started firing, they weren't ever going to stop. They were continued even when we had reached the first objective and reorganising. They still went on. In fact, the guns didn't stop until 4 o'clock in the morning, having started the barrage at 1:05. 3 hours non-stop. 300 guns. It was quite something. We're still talking now about the colonel giving out his orders. He told us that the boundaries of each brigade were going to be indicated every 2 minutes by a red tracer from Beaufort's firing along the line of advance. Now, the boundaries of each brigade, if I remember rightly, we had a Beaufort on the right, which was between our brigade and the Maoris, another Beaufort on the left between the 6th Durham, so that was some little way over, and the Scottish troops. But in fact, they really, quite apart from showing the boundaries, proved a first-rate indication of the direction of advance. We also had a recognition signal, which wouldn't have been used until a fairly late stage of the battle, which was red tracer fired from rifles and Brens by all British troops as a recognition signal. So you could have a situation where maybe a platoon found itself isolated on the final objective on its own, wanted to let everybody know, including the tanks, who sometimes had a nasty habit of shooting up our own chaps, that they were in fact British troops. So it was arranged for that recognition signal.
Must have been rather difficult to tell one soldier from another, and especially at night.
Well, you'd have had a group probably of two or three. No, the point of it all was that you had a section maybe was stuck somewhere quite a long way away from the company headquarters or another platoon. So they simply fired the red to indicate that they were British troops in that area. Now, you'd simply see the red tracer going up, and you might, through all the dust and everything, you might just pick out a few shadowy figures. But at least you knew they were British, and they weren't German. He then went on to tell us that the Germans on the battalion front were elements of the German 90th Light Division, which were our old friends of the Gazelle days, and the German 164 Infantry Division, with part of an Italian division there, the Trieste. And the Germans, of course, as I've said, were our old adversaries from Gazala days. So that was everything that happened until we actually moved off at 4:30 up into towards the Australian positions. Now, this happened around 4:30 when we marched to an assembly area near Tel El Isa station. The company transport followed, but the B echelon vehicles had been left back in the rear area. A thing that irritated us, and it happened again on Sicily, was to find that as we peeled off the track into an area where we could sort of sit down and have a meal, there's a newsreel cameraman standing on the top of a Humber shooting brake, busy filming everybody in all directions. And I think we actually resented the fact that he was there. You know, we didn't like the idea of somebody being in our war in that sort of position. And it was a funny thing, but people did resent. Didn't mind the war correspondent so much, but they did seem to resent any guys who were filming, because it made the whole damn thing look as though we were practicing something, and it was all very real, so far as we were concerned. Anyway.
Did you see a lot of war correspondents?
No. Not a lot, actually. I never remember one being attached to my company or platoon at any time. There may have been one back at battalion headquarters. But they had a pretty wide area to cover. And I don't think... Well, they never got down to company level with us, anyway.
Did the troops get hold of newspapers and magazines and things like that?
Well, there was a thing called 8th Army News, I don't think, was brought out until after Tripoli, because I think it started in Tripoli. They didn't have a lot, I don't think. Only what they'd been able to bring back from the... if they'd been on leave in Alex or Cairo or somewhere else. So I don't think that... at that time, I don't think there were many newspapers floating around. In any case, they wouldn't have told us anything, because in those days, you got a report of a battle, which was maybe, you know, quite a long time after it actually took place. There wasn't the sort of reporting you get these days, I don't think. But they gave us a hot meal immediately we got into this little assembly area, meat and vegetable stew, and the troops settled down in bomb craters and slit trenches. Almost immediately we got strafed by German planes who were having a go at us, and also a go at the long column of troops that was still going up the tracks that we had been moving up. But our own ACAC, which was pretty good, drove them off pretty quickly. And we didn't have any casualties except a lance corporal, one of my lance corporals. Somebody trod on his tea mug and upset it. And he stood up and shook his fist and shouted out, "Why can't you wait for seconds out of the ring?" And then when sunset came, A, B and C companies, we moved off. We got onto this blessed track, which I think was called Boomerang Track, and infiltrated between the troops and the supply vehicles and the tanks. We were marshalled in by the military police and started this awful 7-mile walk up to the forming up point. The sand on Boomerang Tracks had been churned up so much by tank tracks and snow that it was really like trudging through snow. The sand was powdered, and in places it was almost a foot deep. You were sort of dragging your feet through it. And you've got to remember that we were, in fact, in column of threes by now, as it was, as it had gone the sun, you know, the early evening. Troops were carrying rifles, Bren guns, carrier bags with grenades in them, sticky bombs, picks and shovels. And of course, every time we were overtaken by a convoy of lorries or tanks or anything, we were completely showered in this powdered sand, until eventually there wasn't a man in the battalion who wasn't completely covered in sand. So that was a pretty miserable trudge for 7 miles.
Why couldn't they have taken you up in transport?
It could well be that the transport wasn't available, but more likely that the noise of a lot of troop carriers moving around in the Australian positions would have told the Germans that there was something up.
But It's a long way to go, isn't it, before going into battle?
Well, 7 miles wasn't much. Not really, it wasn't. It's not much under normal circumstances. But it was a hell of a lot because the tracks had been churned up so much. And you had to follow them. There was nothing else you could do. So it became a bit more of a chore than it would have been otherwise. I mean, we marched something like 23 miles on Sicily in one day during the heat of the day. At least it was evening. We weren't marching in the sun.
You said they were carrying sticky bombs. What were they intended
to put on the tanks? If you've got the best way to knock a tank out, if you instead of leaving it standing there, is to put a sticky bomb on it and blow it out. Although C Company had a rather more uncomplicated method of firing very pistols into the tanks, which, as you can imagine, is fairly dangerous if you're doing it. But anyway, after this awful march, we arrived at 11:15 on the FUP. It was a full moon. The enemy very lights were going up. I think they had reached the conclusion that something was up, you know. And the men spaced themselves out along the white tapes that had been laid by our own intelligence section earlier that day. So the chaps just spaced themselves out and sat down, took their equipment off, lay down. 11:15, we'd got nearly 2 hours to wait before we actually went.